Journey to Topaz by Yoshiko Yoshida. Chapter 5. Inside the Barbed Wire. It was their last day in the house where Yuki had spent all her life until now. The furniture was gone, the cupboards and shelves were empty, and all that remained were three mattresses on the floor where they would sleep one more night. In the morning, the blankets would be put into their going-to-camp bundle, and Mrs. Nelson would see that Salvation Army picked up the old mattresses. Yuki could hear Mother's footsteps echoing in the empty house as she went from room to room, sweeping out the floors and making a last check. "What difference does it make whether the house is clean now?" Yuki asked, puzzled. But Mother was neat and conscientious to the end. Of page 42. "Of course it matters," she said. "I want to leave a nice clean house for whoever will rent it after we're gone." "What we should have done is bought this house," Yuki said slowly. She hated the idea of anyone else living in it. It was their house, and nobody else belonged in it. The owner, Mr. Rudolphson, had said as much. "It won't be the same, Mrs. Sakani," he had said sadly. "I hate to see you go." Mother reminded Yuki, however, that the people who owned their homes had the problem of finding someone suitable to rent and maintain their houses while they were gone. Whether one owned or rented, it was a difficult time for anyone who was Japanese. Mimi's mother invited them to dinner on their last night. She made roast turkey with all the trimmings, as though it were Thanksgiving or Christmas, and for dessert she baked two different kinds of pie so Ken could have a piece of each. "Just in case you don't get any homemade pie for a while," she explained. Mr. Nelson reminded them again and again that they were too right if there was anything he could do for them while they were in camp. "Me too," Mimi added eagerly. "Write me if you want anything." Then she hurried to her room and brought presents for each of them. There was a box of initialed white linen handkerchiefs for Mother, a lei of lifesavers for Ken, and for Yuki a red leather diary wrapped in pink tissue and ribbon. "So you can put down everything that happens to you and write me about it," she told Yuki. It was a pleasant evening, and for a while Yuki almost forgot why they were having dinner at Mimi's at all. When they got home, page 43, Mrs. Jameson came to say goodbye in case she missed them in the morning. "My, we can't even offer you a chair," Mother said, looking around at the emptiness that surrounded them. "Not even a cup of tea." Mrs. Jameson waved away Mother's concern and fumbled inside the small beaded bag she carried on her arm. She pulled out a small white envelope and pressed it into Mother's hand. "This may come in handy some day," she whispered, "or if you can get something nice for the children." She promised to take good care of Old Salt, and then with a quick hug, smelling of lavender and spices for each of them, she was gone. When Mother opened the envelope, she found a crisp $20 bill. Yuki woke up the next morning, feeling the blankets being pulled off. "Hey!" she shouted, trying to hold on to them. But Ken quickly deprived her of their warmth and stuffed them into the big rucksack. "Get going, Yuki," he warned. "We have to be at the civil control station in just 1 hour." Yuki shivered without her blankets, but she wanted to stay curled up on her own mattress, on her own floor, in her own room for as long as possible. She didn't leap up until she heard the front doorbell and Mrs. Nelson's cheerful voice as she brought over a tray of coffee and hot chocolate and sweet rolls oozing with butter. When Mrs. Nelson came back later with Mimi, it was to drive them to the church, designated as the civil control station, where all the Japanese were to report. Page 44. Mimi squeezed Yuki's hand. "Are you ready?" she asked. "I guess so," Yuki said lamely, but she didn't really know what she was ready for. All her belongings were gone, and her room was empty, but whether she was ready for what lay ahead, Yuki didn't know. She felt numb and strange, as though she were inside somebody else's body. Mr. Nelson helped Ken secure ropes around their big camp bundle and squeeze it into the trunk of the car. They put the baggage on the floor between their feet and carried smaller bundles on their laps. There was no room for Mr. Nelson to come with them, and he stayed behind, waving until their car turned the corner. Yuki tried to smile as she waved, but she couldn't make her mouth do as she wished. In fact, she wasn't sure whether she had control of her stomach either, and for a few tense minutes she was afraid she might lose her breakfast. She felt pale and green, and when she glanced at Mother, she noticed that the color was gone from her face as well. The grounds of the Congregational Church were crowded with people and baggage and armed soldiers. Hundreds of Japanese had gathered from all parts of the city, looking like refugees, with their odd-shaped bundles and assorted belongings. There were children running around, and others were crying. There were deputies telling people what to do with their baggage, and much to Ken's relief, there were dozens of big trucks into which all their baggage was being loaded. "Whew," he said, grinning for the first time that morning. "I won't have to carry that rucksack into camp after all." "They should have told you there'd be trucks," Mimi said indignantly. Page 45. "I'll say," Yuki agreed. "I would have brought lots more things if I'd known." "That's exactly why they didn't tell us about the trucks," Mother said knowingly. But now the Nelsons were being directed to unload their passengers quickly and move on. There was a mad jumble of hugs and kisses. "Be careful now. Don't forget to write and send me your new address," Mimi called. "I will. I won't. I will." Yuki scarcely knew what she was saying or doing. She was being hugged. Mother was bowing and Ken was shaking hands. And then they were making their way into the big assembly hall, passing the soldiers who stood at each doorway with bayonets mounted and ready. Inside there were hundreds of Japanese people, and the low rumble of their voice filled the large hall as they exchanged greetings and rumors. Old people were sitting quietly, looking patient and resigned. Mothers were comforting crying infants. Youngsters were shrieking and running about. Young people were greeting their friends, and through all the commotion, the women of the church moved in and out, serving sandwiches and coffee and milk. No one felt like eating, however, and the sandwich tray remained mostly untouched. The minister of the church was going from group to group, shaking hands, greeting those he knew, and comforting those who looked bewildered and frightened. Ken found some of his classmates and went over to talk to them, laughing and joking to cover up what he really felt. Mother sat quietly on one of the folding chairs, and Yuki went to sit beside her. She wished Father, page 46, were here. Surely he would have found some way to comfort Mother, to take away the bleak look on her face. Yuki felt scared, but there was also the strange excitement of plunging into a new adventure. She had just found some of her own classmates and went to talk to them when it was time to line up, board the buses. The buses, like giant vacuum cleaners, were sweeping up all the Japanese from the streets of the city. As Yuki waited to get into one, she noticed large groups of people gathered around the street to watch. She wondered, what were they thinking? Were they relieved to see the Japanese go? Were they glad to be rid of them? Some of them chatted gaily, some looked grim, and some simply stared blankly. The buses sped quickly down familiar streets, past the high school, past the little Japanese food store, its windows now boarded up, past the markets where they often went food shopping, and then down the approach toward the Bay Bridge. Instead of going to San Francisco, however, the buses continued down the Bayshore Highway, taking the same route Father followed when he drove visitors from Japan to Stanford University to see the chapel and campus. Today, however, everything on the highway seemed different. Maybe it was because she felt so different inside, Yuki thought. Maybe because she wasn't Yuki Sakane today, but simply a number sitting on a special bus. It wasn't long before Ken pointed to the grandstand of Tanforan Racetrack looming on the left of the highway. Yuki could see the barbed wire fence that encircled the entire area and the tall watchtowers that pierced the fences at regular intervals. Page 47. The buses turned in toward the racetrack and moved quickly between the armed guards who stood at the gates. "Well, here we are at the Tanforan Assembly Center," Ken said dryly. It was one of 15 such centers that had been rushed into completion on fairgrounds and racetracks to house the 110,000 Japanese who had been evacuated from the west coast of the United States. The buses moved slowly toward the grandstand area, and as Yuki turned to look back at the gates, she saw the armed guards swinging them shut. There was no turning back now. They were locked inside.